Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in for Rich Fisher.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
When the Woody Guthrie Center in downtown Tulsa opened as the home base for the Woody Guthrie Archives about 3 years ago, many in our community saw it as not just a tremendous boon for the cultural, artistic, and scholarly life of this city, but also as a triumphant homecoming, maybe even an overdue returning and embracing of one of Oklahoma's greatest, make that one of America's greatest, singer-songwriters. As a troubadour and truth-teller, as a folk musician and political commentator, as an artist and satirist and protester and storyteller, Woody Guthrie remains beyond compare. And he seems to be as present and visible in American life as he's ever been, despite the fact that he died at 55 in 1967. We're talking about Guthrie's life and work on today's show as we learn about the third annual Woody Guthrie Symposium, Woody Guthrie at the Crossroads of American Cultural Life. It happens on Saturday the 30th. Here on the TU campus, it's a day-long event at the Lorton Performance Center, and this is, of course, Guthrie we're hearing in the background right now. This upcoming symposium will be jointly presented by TU and the Woody Guthrie Center in downtown Tulsa, and our guests today are TU faculty members Randall Fuller and Brian Hosmer, who spoke recently with Rich Fisher about the symposium. Fuller is the Chapman Professor of English and Hosmer the Barnard Professor of Western American History. And they tell us about the various scholarly presentations that will comprise this symposium. Again, it's entitled Woody Guthrie at the Crossroads of American Cultural Life, and it happens on Saturday at the Lorton PAC. And they also tell us about some of the many music performances happening in Tulsa in the coming days in connection with this symposium. These concerts will happen at the Lorton PAC, the Canes Ballroom, and the Guthrie Green. And here, in conversation with Rich Fisher, again, our professors Randall Fuller and Brian Hosmer of the University of Tulsa.
Brian and Randall, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Good to be here.
Just a few years ago, we had a big symposium on Woody Guthrie. Why the decision to do another one this year?
Well, this has been 3 years since the 2012 symposium, and that one was really oriented towards celebrating the centenary of Woody Guthrie's birth and also celebrating the arrival of the Guthrie Archives here to Tulsa. This is a little bit different. We want to focus firstly on the Woody Guthrie Center itself and what's happened in the last 3 years, what kind of use scholars have made of the archives, and then moving out from there, you know, think about the impact of the Guthrie Center on the cultural life here in Tulsa. An awful lot's happened since 2012 down in the Brady District. A lot's happened here at TU. So it's really an opportunity to think about the last 3 years, celebrate what's happened, and also where we're going as a community.
Yeah. Randall, are scholars using the facility?
They are. I should say I use the facility, and when I go to the archive, I always see two or three other folks utilizing this wonderful, vast archive of Woody Guthrie materials.
And what sort of things are you looking? How do you use it in your own? Give us some background of your own scholarly pursuits.
Sure. I'm mainly a 19th century American culture person.
How does that have to do with very much a 20th century cultural figure?
That's a great question. Guthrie, in a lot of ways, is part of a tradition that I see extending back to somebody like Walt Whitman or Ralph Waldo Emerson, trying to speak to the American public about America. And so my interest in the 19th century is kind of extended into the 20th because we have this unparalleled archive.
So for both of you, give us a sense of the things you're using out of the archive.
Well, Woody collected all kinds of things. I mean, he has this incredible collection of notebooks, and they speak to all kinds of things. So there are song lyrics, there's paintings in there. I mean, Woody, he sometimes has song lyrics and then paints over them, and there's sort of this multimedia kind of expression. And through this, you get a sense, as Randy was saying, about sort of American cultural life. From my perspective, as an historian of the U.S. West, I see him also as a Westerner, as somebody who speaks about the Southwest, speaks about conditions outside of the coasts, outside of New York, but also translates those experiences to people in Los Angeles and New York. And so it's a way that connects the heartland with the coasts. And I think Woody's writings and his experiences really speak powerfully to that.
You know, he crisscrossed up and down that West Coast in the 1930s, often having to do with the unionization of the West. Is there a lot of material devoted to that, describing what he saw when he saw like a camp of locked out workers or things like that?
Woody's songs do that.
Yeah.
So I mean, Woody kept notes and he was interested in everything, but he has an experience. He sees somebody in a camp or he hears or reads something in the newspaper that particularly strikes him, and he writes about it. And so in a way, this sort of daily writing lyrics, the daily sort of poetry, is that kind of travelogue that we can see. And he does this deliberately.
Guthrie was also, he had this public persona, but he also was a learned man in his own way. Are you gleaning things? Did he read Whitman, Thoreau, and the like?
He definitely read Whitman, and he also read Faulkner. That's what I'm finding lately. He clearly was reading Faulkner, and he's not only a songwriter, but of course he's a novelist as well. And he seems to have adopted in Bound for Glory this kind of rolling, almost stream of consciousness style that we see with somebody like Faulkner or the other modernists.
Mm-hmm. And was it so it's really out of Faulkner, you think, Bound to Glory?
Well,
except it's his own unique way of writing, right?
Yeah, it's very much his own unique way of writing. I just came across a letter that Guthrie wrote to Alan Lomax in the early 1940s, where he says, "Music is a form of electricity that turns a man into an antenna." And I like that a lot, because Guthrie seems to be a kind of cultural antenna, somebody who's picking up all of these different wavelengths from American culture and then combining them in his own unique way.
And that seems to be the focus of this symposium,
it
right?
It is. It is. And in fact, along the sort of cultural antenna, one of our speakers, Thomas Connor, who people in Tulsa know in many different ways, is really going to focus very specifically on the development of Woody's radio persona. You know, and if we imagine Woody Guthrie in Okemah, he's listening to AM radio at night, and he's listening to Lead Belly and stations out of Memphis and New Orleans. And so he's grabbing this, and he becomes a sponge. And these things continue as he goes to California and meets new people. He meets people like Will Geer in California. That really influences the way he thinks. And then ultimately he's in Greenwich Village, right? And he's learning there. He becomes deeply immersed in that scene in a very profound way. Even though his radio persona is of this Okie, he's hanging out with the Greenwich Village people. Those are his people.
Well, we just had Michael Dougherty on, who premiered a piece over the weekend, the composer, and he did a lot of research at the archives as well. And he said, you know, he was listening to Prokofiev. You know,
yes.
He was listening to all the modernist composers.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, he came away with the idea that he was two very different Woodies. He had this very public, folksy Woody, and that was a genuine part of him. But he also was striving to learn something all the time, and I think that's what he did both in the West Coast scene and later when he was in New York.
I think that's one of the things that makes him such a compelling character, is that he absorbs so much, but he's willing to change and rethink and kind of reexamine his own views. I mean, Woody Guthrie at a period of time is interested in klezmer music, right? And even sort of composes some klezmer music. This is the Greenwich Village scene, right?
Right.
I mean, and so you have this Okie troubadour, you know, playing with people with clarinets, right? And so that's an interesting part of the conversation.
So you mentioned Thomas Connor, who
right.
used to write for the Tulsa Tribune when it mm-hmm. was here, and of course later Chicago, and now I guess he's out in California.
Yes.
He's talking about those early radio shows. Do those radio shows still exist? Are they a part of the archive at all?
You know, I don't know if the recordings are part of the archives, but there are recordings at Smithsonian, I believe, and, mm-hmm. and Smithsonian Folkways has worked on some of these things, at least to the extent that they exist. I think some of his notes from radio performances in California are in the archives.
That's
I
right.
mean, sort of his right, description of what's going on in there.
Yeah. So, and how useful are documents like that for a scholar? You know, just even notes on a radio script.
They're incredibly useful. One of the things I think, whether you're a literary scholar or a historian, that you try to do is reconstruct imaginatively what a particular time looked like and felt like and smelled like. And you really, really get a sense of that when you can open up these notebooks or look at notes for a dance that he was working on with Martha Graham's dance company, or just letters home, which there's plenty of those as well. You really get a sense of the time, the place, and then this unique and incredibly creative personality in that time and place.
So scholars have been using the Woody Guthrie archives for about 2 or 3 years. Is it just the tip of the iceberg at this point as far as what we're learning about him, or do you think we're really getting through this material really quickly? Or
I think there's more to it than that. For one thing, scholars have been in these archives for a while. When they were in New York, some of these scholars started using them, but they're far more accessible now and easier to use, and they're sort of set up in a way for scholars. I don't think we're anywhere near understanding and exploring Woody. There are a lot of different ways to read his materials, but the Guthrie Center is also continuing to collect. And so most recently, they've had a donation of the Phil Oakes collection. And what we're finding is that historians and scholars working in archives know this, is that when you add other voices and other collections, all of a sudden those documents that you read one time look very different, right? And so we're, through the sort of continuing collection, able to really think about Guthrie in an increasingly broad context. I think one interesting example from one of our speakers, Mark Fernandez, who's at Loyola University New Orleans, has this interesting project that deals with Woody Guthrie's ideas on science. And Guthrie was fascinated with the atomic age. He admired Albert Einstein greatly, wrote Einstein letters. Now, there's no evidence that Einstein ever wrote him back, but he wrote Einstein letters, said, "This is fascinating. Tell me more about the atom." And so he was incredibly interested in, at first, the promise of the atomic age, and then becomes, like many people, really frightened about the implications of it. So his, you know, as we keep adding things and thinking differently about Woody, we move to all of these different parts of his life and his experiences that intersect with American culture in the post-war era in all kinds of profound ways.
I want to ask you to focus on that idea that more material can change the way you view, say, a document. Can you give us a sense of how that can change from, you know, seeing another viewpoint that it's expressed through a different source?
Well, it can happen directly. And so you can find another set of documents that where this other person was in the same, had the same experiences in the same place as Woody. So Phil Oakes and Woody, or Phil Oakes is thinking about Woody in a certain context, and maybe that moment looks a little bit different. But what it also does is offers this sort of sense of context. It contextualizes Woody even more basically for us.
My guests today are Brian Hosmer, the H.G. Barnard Professor of Western American History, and Randall Fuller, the Chapman Professor of English and Chair of English at the University of Tulsa. The University of Tulsa, as a part of the third anniversary of the Woody Guthrie Archives, is hosting a symposium. It takes place Saturday, April 30th at the Lorton Performance Center here on the TU campus. And I assume it's designed to coincide with all the events at the Guthrie Center, because there's a lot of events at the Guthrie Center as well. Del McCrory on Thursday, and then free music at the Guthrie Green on Friday and Saturday. So I assume.
Right. Well, this is all a coordinated kind of set of celebrations. And I think that it's interesting because the Guthrie Center does a lot of things, right? And so it's about music, it's about Woody, it's about social justice, it's about reaching out to the community, it's about education. And so each of these events kind of has us look at the Guthrie Center in a broad fashion and its various impacts, and also different constituencies. People link with this place in different ways.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing about Guthrie's writings, his music, and really going back to that interview with Doherty, he was saying that the more I looked at it, you know, he was a writer who just set his writings to music. And oftentimes it was public domain songs over the years. Mm-hmm. And I assume that would appeal to someone like you. I mean, when you're looking at it, are you thinking of his song lyrics more as poetry or narrative? Or probably both.
Probably both. The song lyrics are a really interesting example of poetry that is both original and also borrowed from the past. So that in some ways, Guthrie is a cultural aggregator who's pulling ideas from the past and then mixing them up with his own. As a writer, a novelist, the thing that I continue to think about Guthrie, and it just becomes more and more reinforced when I look at his archive, is that he did what all great artists try to do, which is he looks at things and then tries to describe what he actually sees without all of that overlay of conventional wisdom and public opinion and ideology that most of us bring to our ideas when we see something. That is to say, he looks at the world and he describes it as clearly as he can in his lyrics and in his novels. And I find that really rare, exceptional, and kind of wonderful to interact with.
I want to ask you another literary question. You know, the University of Tulsa has this incredibly strong collection of early 20th century and late 19th century English, for the most part, writers in their archives. Is this a completely new direction for this particular city, or are there connections you can make between some of the archives that are already a part of this community and are utilized in research, say, you know, everything from Rebecca West to, you know, V.S. Naipaul and Paul Scott and right. many others? Can we make connections between these various
We certainly
archives?
Can. And some of our guests on Saturday would make the argument that Woody Guthrie is a modernist, mm-hmm. that his second wife, Marjorie, who danced with Martha Graham, was right at the center of modernist thinking in New York City in 1940. And Guthrie's aesthetics in many ways look like modernist aesthetics. Where I think there's a great parallel between the archive at TU and this relatively new Woody Guthrie archive is that they both founded something new in Tulsa. As a result of the archive at the McFarland Library here, we became a premier department of modernist literature. And now Tulsa as a city, I think, is becoming a premier location of popular American music and culture.
Indeed.
And I was going to ask about the Bob Dylan archive. Yeah. What does this do with a combination of the Woody Guthrie archive and the Bob Dylan archive?
I think it affirms some of the things we've been describing. I mean, Dylan travels to New York to meet Woody Guthrie, right? That's why he goes, right? And that's his mission, and he wants to be Woody Guthrie. After he wanted to be Elvis, and then he wanted to be Woody Guthrie at that point. And so the fact that the archives are here really make a great deal of sense, and we get, again, a broader sense of the trajectory. I mean, so we have Woody's papers, and then we have Phil Oakes, and we have Dylan, who sort of is the new Woody but takes things in his own direction. And so this is an opportunity, again, for Tulsa to really situate itself at the center of not only the study of American popular culture and American music, but I would argue also the performing of American popular culture, because the other link here is with our vibrant music and arts scene that also owes a lot to Woody, owes something to Bob Dylan, and then so many other luminaries as well. And so there's also an aspect of this that isn't just scholars looking at dusty archives and reading about dead people or old people. It's also about how those works and those archives inform who we are and where we're going.
You know, I know you guys might have not have seen what's actually in the Dylan archive yet from a scholarly point of view, but I also think of Dylan as being a very different animal than Guthrie, because Dylan was always a popular artist as opposed to Woody Guthrie, who really became mostly popular after his death.
Right.
I mean, he becomes a popular figure more. I mean, he was more of a...
But Woody wanted to be a popular. I mean, this was his living.
Yeah.
And Woody Guthrie wasn't a great businessman, but he also wasn't simply a philanthropist with his music. He went to Los Angeles to become famous as a radio star, and he wanted to be in the public eye. He wanted to make money. And so, you know, his struggles in some sense have to do with his politics, and they fly in and out of favor. Also his health. Right. By the middle 1950s, Guthrie really isn't able to do very much. Right. At least performance wise, not writing as much at that point. But I don't think the division between an artist and sort of a popular figure is that quite that stark. I mean, I think Woody wanted to be known. He wanted to be listened to. He wanted to have an impact.
Well, let's talk about some of the scholars. You've mentioned a couple that are coming in. And I think Professor Fuller, you just alluded to another one that's coming in, Will Kaufman from the UK, mm-hmm. who's looking at this idea of Woody Guthrie as a modernist. What was he going to talk about?
That's a great question. I haven't seen his paper, but my guess is that he's going to talk about Guthrie again at this intersection in New York City, which in 1940, that is the kind of clattering, incandescent center of American modernism. And Guthrie is involved in literary modernism at that time and in dance and performance art at that time. And I think Kaufman's going to look at him in that context.
What are some of the other interesting speakers going to be coming?
Yeah, I mentioned Mark Fernandez, who's interested in science. We also have a session that's going to be moderated by Bob Santelli, who's the head of the Grammy Museum and a good friend of the Woody Guthrie Center. And he's bringing in Jeff Place, who's with Smithsonian Folkways. And Jeff is really a scholar of American folk music and American music generally. And Folkways has done this great work, as you well know, of re-digitizing, re-recording, re-releasing both the material but also explanations, right, biographies. So Jeff Place is going to be here to talk a little bit about Woody Guthrie's country music influence, or the country music influences on Woody Guthrie. Ron Cohen is a scholar of the American folk music scene, particularly the folk revival, and also a collector and a great friend of the Woody Guthrie Center. And he's really interested in this Greenwich Village scene and sort of who are Woody Guthrie's friends and what's his support network and how does Woody, you know, become this Okie troubadour who operates out of New York City. And this is really interesting to him. Tom Connor, right, is in that session. We also have one of our colleagues, Andrew Wood from the History Department, who's going to, in the third session, sort of begin to move us in some other different directions and think about kind of this family tree, sort of Woody and his children, and focus specifically on Ry Cooder. Ry Cooder and Taj Mahal as grabbing a hold of one aspect of Woody's writing, but I think particularly the political aspect of it. I mean, Ry Cooder is interested in bankers, right? And writes a lot about bankers. And so, you know, he's following up on the Jolly Banker and sort of taking it in that direction. So we have that. We have Sterling Harjo, the Seminole and Muskogee filmmaker, This May Be the Last Time, Barking Water, one of the truly great young filmmakers who lives here in Tulsa. And Sterling's going to talk about Woody as an influence on his work, but also as an inspiration to Native artists and sort of the kinds of things that he says. Woody doesn't speak directly about Indian things except for Oklahoma Hills.
Certainly his last film was all about the downtrodden and the people at the
Absolutely.
Bottom rung of the
ladder. And very much a Woody Guthrie-inspired film, I think, a terrific film. And so Sterling's going to be here. And then we close with David Amram, who has a decades-long career as a composer and as a arranger and as a performer.
He knows everybody in music.
Every single person in music. He met Woody Guthrie in 1956. And so right. he
and
will...
And literature. I mean, he's
yeah,
good
oh,
friends
no.
with Jack Kerouac. And
right.
He was. And,
right.
And, he with, actually, and with Hunter Thompson yeah. and with a, sort of this whole range of people.
I think yeah. he played piano for either Allen Ginsberg or Kerouac when they were doing
he
live
did.
Recitations
he
of their
did.
Poetry.
And he played with... He played French horn with Oscar Pettiford's band, and Pettiford was from Okmulgee,
yeah.
and one of the great jazz
first composer in residence of the New York Philharmonic.
Exactly,
too.
And so I think that Amram is going to pull this together in all kinds of ways. And if you've never heard him speak, I mean, just in an incredibly entertaining fashion, he sort of still has that kind of Beat Generation stream of consciousness aspect to his speaking, and it'll really sort of take us back to Greenwich Village in some yeah. ways, right?
The Woody Guthrie Symposium takes place this Saturday at the Lorton Performance Center. Is there advance reservations needed?
There are advance reservations, and you can go onto the TU website, and there's an easy registration process. If you can't find it, contact Randy or me, and we'll certainly direct you there.
UTulsa.edu. And again, this is part of the third anniversary of the Woody Guthrie Archive, so there'll be music Thursday evening at the Canes with...
At the Canes with Del McCurry.
Yep, and then right. Friday and Saturday, there'll be live music. I think Jimmy LaFave's closing it out on Saturday
right.
night at the Guthrie Green.
Right.
A lot of great
and
music.
Anna Canoni, I should mention, Woody Guthrie's granddaughter, Nora Guthrie's daughter, is going to host a listening party that will focus on a kind of recovered and remastered 1949 Woody Guthrie concert. And so Sunday morning at 11:30 at the Guthrie Center, we'll actually get to listen to Woody, and Woody will speak for himself as one component of this as well.
Now, so there's also one other ticketed event with the Red Dirt Rangers.
Red Dirt Rangers on the 1st, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's all sorts of things going on. You can go to the Woody Guthrie Archive site to see a lot of that, as well as the UTulsa site. And so as we close out, you know, we have this great archive that both of you gentlemen are utilizing and other scholars are utilizing. When the Bob Dylan archives are in place as well, which the University of Tulsa has an interest in, do you expect your interest to expand to include that archive as well?
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. We've actually had a conversation just about an hour ago about these kinds of things.
Yeah, the example I like to give is 100 years ago when the Walt Whitman and Emerson archives first became available, it would have been exciting to have been at those locations then. And I feel as though we're in that location now with the Dylan and the Guthrie archives.
How does that change your own scholarships? Because your own scholarships had very little to do with Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan, but just having that archive in your hometown, it has to affect your scholarly interest.
It absolutely does. I mean, these materials draw you to them. But you know what's interesting? You don't leave aside your prior scholarly interests. We bring our interests to these archives and read these things through. So it's an opportunity for all of us to broaden our own perspectives and to rethink maybe some of the things that we've been writing about in light of new materials. So it's a great opportunity.
How does that prism affect your earlier scholarly interest, and how does it affect how you look at these materials? Can you find things from your own backdrop of working with your own materials and say, oh, I'm learning this about such?
I mean, the thing that I most notice, if there's a consistent strain in my own interest, it's been the way singular American artists have connected with a large democratic population. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, it's not a very far step at all from the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century.
Yeah. And my work considers sort of subcultures in the American world, and particularly in the American West. I'm interested in American Indians. I'm interested in things like the Dust Bowl. And what this does is offers me an opportunity to think about those communities through a broader prism of American cultural life. I mean, you know, Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash, they're sort of operating in this world that's parallel to the people that I study in other contexts. And so there's a wonderful intersection that helps me, as I say, rethink what I do.
And it certainly will only grow larger once the Dylan archives are available as well.
Yep.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Hope a lot of people come out this Saturday. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Randall Fuller is the Chapman Professor of English at TU, and Brian Hosmer, the Barnard Professor of Western American History, also at TU. They spoke with Rich Fisher about the Woody Guthrie Symposium, Woody Guthrie at the Crossroads of American Cultural Life, happening on Saturday at the Lorden PAC. This event is open to the public, but registration is required. More information at utulsa.edu/Guthrie. Also, you can learn more about the various music concerts happening in connection with this symposium at woodyguthriecenter.org. And on the subject of Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie, we'll go out with one of the first songs Dylan ever wrote. It's called Song to Woody. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. The views expressed on this program are those of our guests and commentators and not necessarily those of this radio station or the University of Tulsa. Thanks very much for tuning us in. We'll see you next time.
I'm out here 1,000 miles from my home, walking a road other men have gone down. I'm seeing a world of people and things. Here paupers and peasants and princes and kings. Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song about a funny old world that's a-coming along. Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn. It looks like it's a-dying and it's hardly been born. Hey, Woody Guthrie, but I know that you know all the things that I'm a-saying.